Previously on Beta.
It saddens and hurts me that the two young men whom I raised to believe in the Ten Commandments have returned to me as two thieves with filthy mouths and bad attitudes.
So that means that our whole solar system could be like one tiny atom in the fingernail of some other giant being.
Shall we play a game?
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, comedian, writer, and producer Mike Drucker tells us why he wrote a book about the landmark video game Silent Hill 2.
You still have a metal pipe and you're hitting monsters, but it was like describing situations that, you know, resonated with certain things I'd been through in the past.
Also, author Amy Gentry on how her grad school experience inspired her to use academia as the backdrop for her psychological thriller, Bad Habits.
And in academia, the cult of personality and that kind of program is like the perfect catalyst for that to go terribly awry.
But first...
And so to the top spot, and can it be any surprise at all to know that my favourite film of 2020, the film that caught me most off guard in 2020, the film that impressed me the most in 2020, is of course Rose Glass's brilliant Saint Maud. I walked out of the film and I just said, bloody hell.
That's British film critic Mark Kermode offering high praise for Rose Glass's debut feature film, Saint Maud. Rose, who wrote and directed the film, was only 29 when Saint Maud premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival in 2019. Saint Maud is an intense, riveting horror film that focuses on a pious nurse named Maud, who is a caregiver for an American dancer and choreographer named Amanda. Maud believes that God speaks to her directly and that their special relationship can help save Amanda's soul. The film is now available for American audiences, so we decided to catch up with Rose to talk about her debut and how she came up with the thrilling idea behind it.
I sort of started coming up with an early version of the idea just as I was finishing film school in 2014, and I was interested in the idea of doing a two-hander between a woman and a voice in her head, and then the story sort of developed very gradually and slowly from there.
You had to make the narrative of the film work on two levels, the real-world story and Maud's inner story. How did you find the right balance for these two levels?
I guess it was just an ongoing sort of balancing act. And it wasn't too hard because I knew that, yes, there sort of needed to be a kind of literal, for me anyway, it was helpful to have a sort of literal real-life logic to everything that she does. But the sort of the lens that we see everything through is obviously through Maud's perspective, and in her mind it's very unambiguous what's going on, and she is in communication with God and she's on this mission and that's what's happening. So it sort of was following through her but trying to keep half an eye on what I thought was really happening, quotation marks.
When you pray, do you get a response?
Sometimes he talks.
You hear his voice?
Most of the time it's just like he's physically in me or around me. It's how he guides me.
Maud's relationship with God is even more intense in the sense that it takes on this kind of physical sensation. Why did you think it was important to include this?
I don't know. I guess I was trying to just think of a fairly universal way in which she connects with God that would be kind of accessible to even sort of secular audiences. I didn't want it to just be this sort of lofty academic thing that we just take it at her word that she's talking to God. I don't know, and she goes to such weird and extreme lengths for the love of this God that I felt the audience needed to get a sense, you know, she needs to be getting something exciting out of it and outside of the ordinaries. The point of the film for me was never in any way to kind of be sort of Christian bashing or kind of, because I think there's plenty of that goes on anyway. And I, you know, obviously I have my sort of cynicisms and deep suspicions of a lot of things to do with organized religion. But for me, the whole film's far more about, it's a far more emotional, psychological film than it is, or spiritual, I guess, as well, but all on a much more sort of intimate, personal sort of nature.
Can you walk us through the process of how you developed the character of Maud?
I guess it's sort of working backwards from the bits of the story that you do know. So I knew in the beginning that the initial hook I was interested in is, you know, young woman with this relationship with the voice inside her head, and then it was going to be this sort of kinky love affair that she was going to have with God, which seemed fun. But then then you sort of take a step back and go, okay, well, if this is the main relationship that's going on in her life and no one else knows much about it, that tells you quite a lot about her already. So it's sort of a question of like the character feeding into the plot, and then when you're stuck with the plot, you look at the character, and it's a sort of back and forth thing.
Forgive me my impatience, but I hope you will reveal your plan for me soon. I can't shake the feeling that you must have saved me for something greater than this. Not that I'm complaining or anything. Amen.
And then obviously casting, you know, more of it's Maud. I would love to say, oh yes, that's exactly how I wrote it, this is great, but it's, you know, she took what I was hoping the character would be and then just made it so much more, just made her something much more complex, I think. And she's just a phenomenal actor, and her range is insane. And she's also just, and it was great because she's just very laid back and fun to work with and super switched on, and made my job a lot easier because both her and Jennifer get things really quickly. We didn't have much rehearsal time, but they'd, you know, we talked about it, they knew what was going on, so they, most takes, they'd get what I wanted pretty quickly, and then we'd usually have a bit of time to sort of try out variations of things, so it was all quite organic, I guess. And then even through the shoot, you know, things about the character keep changing and adding, and great gradual process.
So speaking of Morpheus versatility, there's this shot late in the film where she looks very much like common depictions of Jesus. Was that intentional?
Yes, yeah, Jaquetta Levon, our makeup artist, all around the sort of makeup area that she was in, we just had pictures stuck up of loads of printouts of sort of old religious paintings of all these very sort of more Mary Magdalene and Virgin Mary sort of holy ladies with that slightly pink flushed cheek but perfect sort of marbly skin. And she does look a little Jesus-like as well. Yeah, we wanted her to feel a bit like a painting, and for the film to feel quite painterly. So a combination of Jaquetta being great and... yeah, Ben Fordsman, our DOP. Although he did say actually at one point, he is phenomenal. Like he likes faces beautifully. But he did say to me at one point, he was like, God, Morvish just got one of those faces that looks amazing in every kind of light. And I was like, yeah, so great. Yeah. I've been like standing in for her at one point because we're about the same height. So a lot of the time when she was getting her hair and makeup done, I'd sort of be standing in. We were doing a big close-up and I was there and he was like, oh, I don't know, something's not right. And then Morpheus came in and we swapped places and he was like, oh, that's better.
Jennifer Ely is excellent as Amanda. She's the soul that Maud is trying to save. And Jennifer's performance is very nuanced and it's difficult to get an accurate read on what's going on in her mind, especially about what she thinks of religion. Can you talk a bit about Jennifer's performance?
Oh, I love working with Jennifer. She just made the character so much more nuanced and believable, I think, than maybe what I'd written before, because initially I pictured her being like a lot older and English, so sort of this fabulous theatrical kind of grande, and it just all started to feel a bit sort of, I was like, oh no, she's just going to be this massive lovey, and then it's like, why is Maud obsessed with this like weird old lady? And so Carmel Cochran, our casting director, she suggested Jennifer, and at first I was like, what are you talking about, she's too young and she's American, and then as soon as I got over that and pictured her in it, it was like, ah, that's much better. Let's do that instead.
How long have you been doing this?
Just over a year.
What were you doing before?
I worked at St. Alfred's Hospital.
Horrible place. Have you seen a lot of death?
Yes.
What made you leave?
And it's what God wanted. When he came, everything changed.
So this is a recent conversion.
I like the sort of playfulness. I think she's sort of flattered by Maud's attentions and is sort of intrigued because, you know, she's obviously starting to, you know, she's thinking about existence and death. She's approaching death. And so I think maybe she just Maud happens to catch her at a point when she's maybe more open to those sorts of things than she would have been before. And maybe is treating Maud a little bit more like a plaything or a distraction, which is what Maud misunderstands. And she obviously gets over ahead of herself. But yeah, Jennifer, she just manages to do so much with so little, which for a character who has all the trappings of a very kind of theatrical, over-the-top sort of character, you know, the set and the costumes sort of were doing all of that for her. Or that's kind of what she said once in an interview, which I liked. So it allows her to do a lot less and leave you to just wonder. And I think she's really funny.
yeah, exactly. You're bang on with all those points, I think. You came up with this term to describe something that Maude experiences throughout the movie, godgasms. What are godgasms? It's a great term, great word.
So weird that's just like, I should have come up with a better name because that was just sort of what we ended up calling them when we were shooting.
What could be better, though? What would be a better name?
Well, true, yeah, it's very... very, very subtle, nuanced stuff, as you can tell. But I don't know, it seemed appropriate. God is coursing through her and she appears to be having an orgasm. I mean, maybe to a lot of people who wouldn't believe in God, the idea of, oh, I'm being touched by God, God has given me a message. I think if you don't believe in God, that doesn't mean very much to you. But, you know, suddenly being struck down by an orgasm, that, you know, I think we sort of can imagine what that feels like. But for me, it wasn't purely sexual, to be honest. I mean, obviously, yes, there's definitely sexual connotations to it. But it was more going for a kind of euphoric, transcendent, hallucinogenic kind of thing. I think I told her, like, you're having a whitey, but it feels really good.
Mm. Saint Maud reminded me of Roman Polanski's Repulsion in terms of the artful ways that it portrays loneliness, isolation, and mental deterioration. Was this film an influence in any way?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that's probably not hard to see. I love that film. I mean,
yeah, me too.
I mean, not just that one. There are obviously others, but that was definitely a film which, when I saw it for the first time, I think as a teenager, had quite an impact on me. I think it's just an amazing example of what you can do with one person in a flat, I guess, as a premise, through the tools of filmmaking, storytelling, acting, all of the stuff that we've been talking about. What can you do with what's essentially one woman having a nervous breakdown in her flat and sort of make a whole thing around that? And any films where the imagined sort of becomes real, or the world that you see doesn't conform to the same logic as the world that we live in, I enjoy that a lot.
Mm-hmm. That whole ambiguity thing, which there's lots of in St. Maud. Were there any other particular films or directors that influenced you in the way you approached making St. Maud?
Yeah. Polanski, definitely, you know, typical pretentious film student, big Bergman fan. So I was banging on about Persona and Through a Glass Darkly and The Silence all the time. Be Through a Glass Darkly particularly, that's got some quite obvious links with this film as well. And Ken Russell, so The Devils, love that for some of the, in terms of heightened euphoric ecstatic religious ecstasy and general bonkersness, The Devils is is superb and so much fun. And loads of others I've forgotten, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite scene that you can talk about that doesn't involve any spoilers?
My favorite scene's probably, I don't know, maybe, I think this might just be my favorite scene because it was a scene that I was so nervous about before we filmed it, and then it turned out fine. But there's a scene between Maud and Carol, who's Amanda's kind of girlfriend, lover, whatever. And she's Maud has sort of decided at this point, she's been given this mission by God to save Amanda, and they've been getting closer and becoming friends, and it's all lovely, and she feels the Lord moving through her. But Amanda's sees this younger woman who Maud basically doesn't like, and I think is jealous of her receiving Amanda's affections, and takes her into the kitchen and gives her a sort of talking to.
Can you hear yourself? Maud, you're her nurse.
She doesn't want you to see it, but she is vulnerable right now. And it is not right that she spends her last days getting worked up about a silly girl who doesn't care about her.
I care about her.
Not enough. What are you doing?
I'm leaving.
Oh. Okay, so you'll do it.
Anything you say, Maud.
I just think both Morvith and Lily, the actress who plays Carol, are just so good in that scene. And Morvith is hilarious. I think she is anyway. But it's just seeing her just trying so hard to... She thinks thinks that everything's going very well and she's being very reasonable. But it's like one of the first times, for me, it's good. Like up until that point, I feel like, I hope by that point people sort of realise you can, you know, the film's kind of got a sense of humour, it's a bit playful. But yeah, lovely and excruciating watching people trying and failing to come across the way they think they should. And she doesn't realise that Carol just thinks she's an absolute nutter. But I like people misunderstanding each other and she thinks it goes great.
Mm-hmm. So St. Maud has one of the most powerful endings I've ever seen. I'm wondering, is it possible to talk a bit about how you came up with the ending without describing what happens? Or
yeah, it doesn't go well at the end. Or maybe she thinks, no, I knew I wanted to get to that point, and like the way that we do it in the film, I knew I wanted to get to that point for quite a long time. The mechanics of the story, and particularly the act leading up to it, that sort of final 30 minutes or so, that changed around a lot during script writing during the year or so before shooting. And that was sort of the bit I was most kind of stuck with and kind of banging my head against brick wall with for ages. But I don't know, it felt, without trying to spoil it, it felt like to end it any other way by that point would feel like a bit of a cop-out.
Good answer, yeah. Well, what are you working on now?
I am writing two scripts. I'm co-writing something with a friend, Veronica Tavilska, who I went to film school with. And I mean, I'm sort of at that point now where it's in theory this week or any day now, I'm sort of meant to finish it. And then I'm hoping we can start getting it into gear to actually, I don't know. I'd love to film it this year. And it's a romance, I guess. And the other one I want to write myself, but it's very early days and it's still a bit of a mess at the moment. So I haven't quite worked it out yet. But yeah, looking forward to getting on with more.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to seeing both of those when they're ready, when they're done. Rose Glass, thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Really nice to talk to you.
Rose Glass is the writer and director of the psychological thriller St. Maud. It's Rose's debut feature film. Find out more about Rose and St. Maud at wpr.org/beta.
I kept that frame in the staircase where they're having the current day struggle, partly to give you something a little bit more suspenseful to keep returning you to a single night and a moment that's urgent.
Amy Gentry talks about her latest crime thriller, Bad Habits, a novel of suspense. That's coming up in just a moment. But since we're keeping you in suspense, it will probably seem a bit longer. Trust me, it will be worth the wait. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
In here, I open the stairwell door and pull us both through it. The heavy fireproof door swings shut on the sound of partiers with an echoing metallic crash. If we're gonna fight, let's at least do it where no one can hear us. I don't wanna fight, Mac, Gwen chokes back her tears. I don't wanna fight either. For once in my life, I don't even wanna win. I wanna kill. I've felt it before, and I know the difference.
That's Amy Gentry reading an excerpt from her latest novel, Bad Habits. The two main characters are Mac and Gwen. They used to be the best of friends. They considered themselves sisters, but that all changes when they are both admitted to the same prestigious graduate program. The pressure and competition ramps up, leading to tragic conclusions. Amy Gentry drew on her own grad school experience to write this propulsive, gripping suspense novel. But she didn't start out as a crime writer. In fact, she says that she is an accidental crime writer.
I started writing my first novel, Good as Gone. When I started writing it, I thought of it as a family drama more. And even when I was feeling very extremely confident about it, as kind of a Henry James type psychological fake out novel, a literary novel. And it wasn't until I started really getting into the process and seeing that there were, you know, there was a kidnapping in that novel, there were dead bodies started to appear. And I began to think, perhaps this is actually a crime novel. But I had never been an avid reader of contemporary crime until I wrote that book, really. And it unlocked kind of a whole world for me.
You mentioned Henry James as being an influence on your fiction. How so?
I have always really thrilled to those deep and really weird delves into psychology that he does. And the idea of this tight, intimate circle, usually there's just three, maybe four main characters, especially in those late novels. And the plot really comes from those characters psyching each other out, manipulating each other, lying, but also sometimes surprisingly telling the truth in ways that manipulate instead of reveal. So that is kind of the dynamic I'm always trying to capture in my novels. And though they don't really, I think, come out like Henry James novels, I do return to that source whenever I'm having a block or I'm just not my voice isn't coming. I'll go back and reread some late James especially. And it doesn't take much to really snap my brain back into that feeling. And once I've written myself through the first draft with all the too long sentences and the fancy language, then I often have the core of what I really want.
Let's talk about your latest novel, your third novel. It's called Bad Habits, and it focuses on this complicated friendship between two young women, Mackenzie Clare Woods and Gwendolyn Whitney. Can you tell us a bit about these two characters?
Yeah, they came to me in a dream, which is not usually the way a novel comes to me. But the vision of these two women reuniting in a hotel lobby after years apart, knowing that they had been once best friends and that now one of them wanted to kill the other is almost all I knew. And the other one of them is getting married and the other one wants to kill her. I dreamed this whole elaborate scenario in the hotel. You know, I started to delve into the psychology of the Mac character, who was the character who would want to kill her former best friend. And I wondered how she had gotten to that place. I thought of setting her in graduate school because I had that background and had sort of been waiting for a chance to use it as a backdrop for a novel. And I thought, what better place for a friendship to turn horrible and ugly than in a graduate program, a highly competitive one? And Mac kind of came from that. I knew she would be a first person point of view character. I wanted her to feel a bit like Tom Ripley from the Patricia Highsmith novels. And so I knew that she had some challenges in her background and that she came to grad school already knowing that she was not enough, never feeling like enough. And that Gwen had been the character who had allowed her to get to grad school, and that following Gwen, who had seemed perfect, you know, rich, beautiful, but also incredibly intelligent and poised, that she had seen Gwen at a young age and attached to her as like, this is who I need to be if I want to be enough, and I'll do whatever she does.
Mm-hmm. Both Mac and Gwen are grad students at Dwight Handler University. Can you talk a bit about this, the program that they're involved in and the culture surrounding it?
Yes, I had a lot of fun with that, making the program and even envisioning the history of this university and the campus was a lot of fun for me. This is a highly competitive program, and I was in a highly competitive graduate program in English in a northern industrial city. And it was my first time ever immersed in that kind of environment. I had come from a very laid back undergraduate experience and had really fallen into this program in Chicago almost by accident as well. And then immediately kind of found my footing and was in it for 6 years, and it became my life. And learning what that kind of environment was like, you know, people behave in bad ways when they are under constant pressure and stress, when there's only a very narrow way for them to succeed and limited resources for success. As in academia, there's no real job market for the humanities. And the people that you rely on to succeed in that environment are over you in this somewhat rigid hierarchy. They're your advisors and professors. And yet there are no boundaries. You're often encouraged to see them as peers and hang out with them as if they're peers. And yet they have total power over you, over your career. And so that was like such a compelling situation for me to put these two young women into, particularly Mac, who's always wanted to please, you know, her mother or her absent father. And it's just looking for someone to put all those feelings onto. And in academia, the cult of personality and that kind of program is like the perfect catalyst for that to go terribly awry.
For sure. And you take full advantage of that. This emerging studies program at Dwight Handler University features some pretty esoteric courses like diasporic feminisms, economimesis, and Professor Bethany Ladd's specialty, ethical negation. And these are actual real areas of study, aren't they?
No.
Oh, they aren't?
Not at all.
Okay, because I wonder, yeah. I thought you did, but I looked it up and I found references to I Googled and I found references to these.
Economimesis is certainly an article that Derrida wrote, and it is a little bit, it's one of the few like private jokes that I allowed myself to keep in the novel, because it was an article that I personally, it became my Waterloo in grad school. Like, I just could not get it, no matter how many times I tried to read it. And so I imagined that there was a professor who had built his whole career on this one article and was sort of a, you know, maybe a bit of a faker. Like, maybe there's a hint that maybe everything going on in this program is a bit of a scam. But at the same time, I didn't want to come down too hard on that, because as with my experience in academia, I actually found that there was so much that was really worthwhile there. It's just that it was often obscured and hard to understand, obscured by status play and insecurities, and also difficult to understand because in an environment of such fear and pressure, it's a terrible environment to learn in. And so one of the sort of, I guess, sleight of hand I was trying to accomplish with the novel, and I hope I did, is that these courses really border right on the brink of something that could be real. Academics will recognize and get a chuckle out of it, I hope, that these are plausible, basically, courses of study. But also I wanted to convey that for Mac, it doesn't even matter if they're real or not. This is from her point of view, and they sound to her like gobbledygook, always just on the brink of becoming understandable, but never quite gets it. So that's how I sort of threaded the needle with that. I wanted them to seem recognizable. I sprinkled real things throughout to kind of tempt people to look it up. But yeah, I mean, I made it up, and I made up emerging studies. It's possible that it's a real thing.
Or it will be once that, you know, now that when your book comes out, who knows, it could inspire a real thing. You really are skewing and satirizing academia in this book. Why did you want to do that?
Well, first of all, it was just fun, Doug. I mean, first and foremost, when I'm writing to please myself. Anyone who's been through an academic program like this comes out of it with a secret desire to write an academic satire, or not so secret. So I've known half a dozen people that swore they had an academic satire that they were writing. And I never really felt comfortable just writing a satire on its own, on its face. But when I came up with this idea for a thriller that had a real, to me, very, like a real heart to it, the plot meant a lot to me. But the joy of setting it in academia was partly that I would get to poke fun, not just like, haha, academics are, you know, silly, because I don't think that's very interesting. And also, they have, you know, value as well. But more to just pull up the feelings under those jokes and show some sort of ugly truths that are happening in that environment where structural inequality is often reproduced.
While I was reading the climactic hotel staircase scene in which Mac and Gwen are confronting each other, I couldn't help but think about the climactic bell tower scene at the end of Hitchcock's Vertigo, in which James Stewart's character confronts Kim Novak's character. Was that something that was on your mind while writing this scene, or am I just overly obsessed with Vertigo?
Oh my gosh, that's such an amazing comparison. No, I have never thought about the bell tower, but that is brilliant. I'm going to just say in the future that that's what it was based on.
Okay, I'm glad you... Yeah.
But I do think psychically, you know, Hitchcock is one of the most psychically astute directors, right? Or was. And the images in his films are so primal and dreamlike, I think, in the way they tap into these aspects of our psychology, that I would not be surprised if it had imprinted, because the stairwell was really the big location in my dream. And I think there's something about that spiral upward, you know, they're climbing, right? Mac's a climber, and has always seen herself as climbing this difficult staircase up to the top. But where are they going, you know, and who is she? Who is she trapped with, and who is she becoming in the process? And I think, Vertigo has a lot of resonance, partly because of the doubles in Vertigo and the way women are sort of molded into one another. Certainly there's some resonance there with how Mac tries to mold herself into Gwen's image. So thank you so much for that.
Oh, no, thank you. Well, thank you for fleshing that out more, because I hadn't taken it to that level about the doubles and things. I hadn't thought it through enough, so thank you. The way you cross-cut between the action in the past and the action in December 2021, that staircase scene we were just talking about, it really adds to the propulsion of the narrative. Can you talk a bit about how you approach writing action scenes in your fiction?
Yes, I always have a sense of character, and I usually have a sense of setting, But action is really difficult for me. I struggle with it. And it often appears to me as, you know, images from a movie, the climactic scene. And I'll see those long before I know why the characters are there and doing what they're doing. I'll see those images and think, that seems like it. You know, I'll bookmark this and kind of, that's where I want to land. And those end up being the plot points that I move toward and structure the novel around. And of course, I'll throw them away if they don't work. It just gives me a motive to really get to that action and work out the plot, because I want to get to that scene and find out what happened. Going back and forth to the past, I always knew that the meat of the book would be in the past, because it's a book about the making of a villain. So we have to see Mac become that over the course of the book. But I kept that frame in the staircase where they're having the current day struggle, partly to give you something a little bit more suspenseful, to keep returning you to a single night and a moment that's urgent. Also because it just felt like the perfect end to their friendship, the capstone on this friendship. So it just felt inevitable to me that they would end up there.
Yeah, it's very well, your whole book is well written, but especially those action scenes, like everything, those are like really, really, really well done. There's a character in Bad Habits named Tess who comes to the program after working for a showrunner, which got me thinking that your novel could easily be a streaming series. So let's talk about the Netflix miniseries based on Bad Habits, which I'm confident is going to happen very soon. I'm thinking Anna Taylor-Joy from The Queen's Gambit would be make a great Mac, and I think Rosamund Pike from Gone Girl would make a great Gwen, or maybe they should be the other way around. Does that work for you?
Oh, yeah, that's a good start. I mean, I have my own ideas about casting, but yeah, the most important idea I have about casting is that I think Kristen Stewart is sort of my Mac, right?
Mm.
I think she's got the, partly because she's a little older and the story takes place in two, you know, she has to kind of be able to switch back and forth between a 10-year gap.
Yes.
But also just because, you know, Kristen Stewart, one of the things I love about her, she looks kind of feral, you know?
Mm.
And I think that that's the look I need for Mac, you know? I think she's got something a little bit feral about her because, you know, she's just watching everything that's happening and clocking it and trying to convert it instantly into, you know, a set of instructions for how she should behave. But I wouldn't call her a sociopath, but she does have this very surfacey relationship to how, you know, how she should be behaving. She's just doing it to get something. So, I mean, there's a million young actresses who would do that part so much justice. And if any of them want to see the script, just give me a call.
Yeah. Fingers crossed that they will.
Absolutely.
Amy Gentry, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, Doug. This has been really fun.
Amy Gentry is the author of Bad Habits, a novel of suspense. You can find out more about Amy and her book at wpr.org/beta.
I didn't relate to the violence, but I definitely related to someone who was so bullied or felt so bad as a teen that they turn inward and they become bitter and angry.
Comedian Mike Drucker joins us to talk about how playing the landmark horror video game Silent Hill 2 impacted his life and career. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. This is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm looking for Silent Hill. Is this the right way?
Yeah. It's hard to see with this fog, but there's only the one road. You can't miss it.
Thanks.
But...
Yes?
I think you'd better stay away. This town, there's something wrong with it.
That's a clip from the popular video game Silent Hill 2. It's a survival horror game that was released in 2001. It sent the player on an unsettling psychological journey to uncover the secrets of this eerie town of Silent Hill. And it made quite an impression on comedian Mike Drucker. So much so that 20 years later, he's written the definitive book about the landmark game. Mike is the co-head writer and executive producer of the TBS late-night comedy show Full Frontal with Samantha Bee. He's also written for The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon and Saturday Night Live. He joined us from his New York home to talk about how Silent Hill 2 resonated with him on a deeply personal level and how his passion for video games in general led to his career in comedy writing.
You know, a lot of the early things I was paid to write, even before I was a professional comedy writer, were I would write little comedy pieces for video game magazines and video game websites about games. I would write little funny joke pieces, little funny like New Yorker style essays about games. And I think that was the start of me getting paid for it. And I think that was a great opportunity for me because it was an area that wanted comedy. It wasn't overcrowded. And it was an area that I knew very well. So I was lucky enough to sort of get my start with that.
Yeah, you even had that great piece for McSweeney's about what the background characters of Street Fighter II are saying.
Yeah.
So that was good. Yeah, that's great. Yeah. So what was your transition like going from video game culture to late night television writing?
Well, I had interned at SNL when I was in college, and I worked there as a researcher for a little bit. So I already sort of knew, you know, like I knew my way around 30 Rock and all that. So I wasn't as intimidated as someone else might normally be. However, you know, a late night show has a different audience. And my first staff TV job was Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, which then became The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon when I was there. And it's an intense job. You know, I'm waking up at 5 a.m. I'm writing jokes. I think, you know, the video game website, everyone worked hard, but it was like, this is about video games. This is not that big of a deal. You know, we'll make it. Don't worry. And with this, even though I would argue that, you know, it's comedy, it's a late night comedy show, just have fun with it. It was taken very, very seriously. And so it was just so much more work, but it was also a good kind of training ground for me. Like it was good to sort of go through comedy boot camp.
As you mentioned, you'd interned and wrote for Saturday Night Live. And while you were working as an intern there, some of the writers noticed your mannerisms and they were parodied by Zach Braff.
That's right.
Zach Braff in a Bronx Beat sketch. Zach even used your name. So I'm assuming that the writers cleared this with you before the sketch aired?
Yeah, they told me. They told me about it. They didn't necessarily clear it with me, but they told me about it. I'm sure if I had raised an objection, they wouldn't have done it. But it wasn't like, is this all right with you? They were like, hey, you're lucky. They didn't say you're lucky we're doing this, but that's how I felt at the time.
So how did you feel about them parodying your mannerisms? Like, and what did you think of the sketch?
Honestly, when you're like, you know, a 20, 21-year-old, maybe 22-year-old intern, it was crazy. Like, it was almost like, you know, it's almost like someone memorializing you in a song. Like, it's like if a popular band was like, we love you so much, we're writing a song about you.
Yeah, let me ask you a question, Drucker. How much you make of this job?
Nothing. It's an internship.
Oh, yeah, well, I got an internship, too. It's called being a mother. I get stuff for people all day long for free.
Yep.
And guess how much money I make a year, Drucker? Nothing, dollars, and 0 cents.
Before taxes.
And it's a small character. It's a small sketch in a recurring sketch series, but it feels like I have this little tiny permanent blip in existence on that show.
Yeah, it's true. That's a good point, and that's a great way to look at it. Let's talk about Silent Hill 2 specifically now. In what ways is Silent Hill 2 different from most video games?
Well, Silent Hill 2, I would actually weirdly say Silent Hill 2 is more like video games now than it was in 2001 when it came out. For anyone who doesn't know, very quick background, I won't waste too much time, but Silent Hill 2 is a horror video game that takes place in a town called Silent Hill, which is supposed to be like every town in America, USA. Like it's a little resort town, but not very middle class, middle of nowhere town. And in the series, most of the games are about this cult in the town, but number two is interesting in that it has nothing to do with the cult, and it's about a bunch of people who are trapped in the town, and over time you sort of learn that they're being punished for something, sort of by a supernatural force that's never quite explained. And the reason it was so unique for the time is because it handled very serious topics very maturely in a way few games had. Now, games have talked about war forever, but Silent Hill 2 was the first game that really seriously dealt with emotional abuse, sexual abuse, you're dealing with characters going through these things, and the game is very careful about it. It's very measured about it. I mean, for the time, obviously, if you play it now, there's little things that are problematic, but it handles it so well and so carefully and gracefully inside a horror game that's really a psychological horror game more than jump scares, that it just created this experience when I first played that just overcame me. You know, it felt like a video game that was, you know, you still have a metal pipe and you're hitting monsters, but it was like describing situations that, you know, resonated with certain things I'd been through in the past. You know, it wasn't just like, it wasn't a power fantasy. It was almost the opposite. It was almost like a cathartic anti-power fantasy.
Mm-hmm. And it's clear from your book that Silent Hill 2 is incredibly personal to you. You said that as a bullied kid, you related to a lot of the characters in the game that were exhausted and sad. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, of course. You know, there's this character, Eddie, who, as you're playing the game, throughout the game, you have little backstories of the characters, but you don't know everything, including the main character. So Eddie is this character that sort of looks like either like a very overweight teen or someone in his early 20s, but sort of a look that I had when I was a very overweight teen, which is, you know, like ill-fitting shirt that's kind of too big, but in being too big, it reveals your size even more. And he's this character who, as he plays, is very sensitive. Whenever you see him, he's always defensive. He's always talking about like how he was bullied. And what you find out about him later is that his sort of crime that got him stuck in Silent Hill, that is that he got violent, kind of the way that we're all too familiar with now, where he took a gun and he shot his bully and he shot his bully's dog. And I didn't relate to the violence, but I definitely related to someone who was so bullied or felt so bad as a teen that they turn inward and they become bitter and angry.
Eddie, have you gone nuts? I knew it. You too. You're just like him, James. Hey, I didn't mean anything.
Don't bother. I understand. You've been laughing at me all along, haven't you? Ever since we first met.
Again, the interesting thing about the narrative, especially for my generation for a long time, was if you're bullied, you know, it's their fault and you should not be bullied. No one should be bullied. But no matter what you turn out with, it's, you know, kind of on the person who bullied you. And in the game, it's like, no, he took that and he went the wrong way with it, which is something I could honestly see myself doing if things went wrong. Not be violent, but I could easily see myself being suspicious of everyone or, you know, refuse to have friends or even like, you know, be sort of like an alt-righty type troll just if things had gone a certain different way. So I really related to that almost like a sliding doors situation that he represents in an exaggerated way for me.
Mm-hmm. Silent Hill 2 also has a character suffering from sexually abusive trauma. You write frankly in the book about your own trauma related to abuse. If you don't mind my asking, did seeing this representation in a video game that you clearly love, did that kind of help you deal with your own trauma?
It did, but I weirdly not until later. When I first played the game, I sort of, you know, and this character is this character, Angela, who's actually my favorite character in the game. When you first meet her, she is searching in a graveyard for her mother, which is confusing until later on you find that she probably killed her father and brother for sexually assaulting her, and she wants to kill her mother for essentially allowing it to happen. The first time I played it, I really didn't make the connection because, you know, not to get into detail, what happened to me felt a little more passive than when you implied what happened to her. But the more I played it, the more I sort of felt like that, like, you know, oh, that's where depression comes from. Or that's when you turn inward with that self-hatred, even though you hate, you know, the neighbor, whoever did this to you, or her, you know, her parents, someone in my neighborhood, not my next door neighbor, if they happen to be listening. It wasn't until a few plays later, and especially while working on this book, when I played through the game a bunch of times, that I really started to develop like a really strong attachment to her in terms of like what she went through. And again, what she went through fictionally is worse narrative, like worse than what I went through in real life, kind of just in terms of apples to apples. However, I definitely felt a lot more sympathy for her, and I definitely felt a lot of catharsis, especially at the end when she sort of goes on her own way and says nobody can help her but herself, which for that character is a huge growth.
It's hot as hell in here.
You see it too. For me, it's always like this.
Near the end of your book, you say that Silent Hill 2 is not a fun video game to play. So why do you play it?
Think of it as, you know, like a lot of movies that we like aren't necessarily super fun movies. You know, like you look at a movie like Requiem for a Dream, and that's a dramatic movie, maybe a little melodramatic, but I would say it's a good movie. It's not fun. I don't enjoy myself watching it. But oftentimes video games are held back by the terminology of game. You know, they're art pieces with stories and narratives. And there's a mistaken belief that a game should be fun, or you should enjoy playing it, or you should be excited to find out what's next. And what I like about Silent Hill, again, is it sort of makes you dread what's next. You kind of don't want to open that door. You know, it's not like a lot of horror games are very run and gun. You know, like at first you're scared because there's a zombie, but 10 hours in, you have a machine gun and you're just mowing down people. You become Rambo. But in this game, you're always weak. You're always running away and you're just sort of always scared. And the mystery of it makes each moment even more suspenseful. You're like, I don't want to find out. I don't want to know. And that makes it even more compelling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. That movie analogy is really good. That really helps me understand that. With so many original games from this era getting remade for next-gen consoles, why did the Silent Hill 2 upgrade fail?
The best comparison, and I thought of this after the book was published, but the Silent Hill 2 upgrade, the way that they did it, and this was for the Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3, was they almost did what I would call the equivalent of, remember like in the 80s when people were like, what if we colorized black and white films? What if we added color to them? That would make them more appealing. But in reality, it removed a lot of the atmosphere. You know, whether or not those directors wished they could use color, at the time they were limited, so they used what they had in the black and white. And Silent Hill 2 is very much the same way. The town's very foggy, for example. And in the game, it makes sense. It's this abandoned town. It's spooky. You know, sometimes it transforms into something even scarier. So the fog gives you that effect. We all know fog and horror. However, the fog also helped systems reduce processing power. If you have a ton of fog, you don't need to process buildings in the distance because they're hidden by the fog. So it was a technique that really helped artistically. And in the HD upgrade, that was one of the things they were like, oh, we don't need this fog anymore because we can just process these buildings. But you remove the fog, again, you remove a lot of the atmosphere. Another example, the voice work of the first game is very ethereal. And it's a game about people who are confused and lost. You know, it's, you know, kind of a Sartre type thing. And they recorded new voices because the old voices were only stereo. They didn't have new voices in surround. So of course they have to re-record these voices, and they hired good actors, but it just feels like they're not getting the story right. Like it feels, you know, it almost feels more like an action game. It feels a little more like they want you to move along. It doesn't feel as contemplative. And maybe that's just because I heard the other voices first, but there's just a lot of little details that made it not ideal. Here, another example, and I'm sorry that I'm rambling, is...
No!
A lot of the time you transition from like a pre-rendered movie, a full motion video, into the game. And because of how it was made specifically for the PlayStation 2 and Xbox, it was kind of a seamless transition. However, when they made the HD remake, it's a lot easier to upgrade a video game's internal graphics than something that was already rendered. And so you have these scenes that are sort of low quality renders and then going into something that looks different. And you don't have quite that, there's a little narrative break there. And again, it's little changes like that that added up to a bad remake or remaster.
Mm-hmm. With it being so difficult to actually experience Silent Hill 2 as the creators intended, what do you think the legacy of this game is?
It's an interesting question. I talked to a few game developers both before and after I wrote it, and the game is pretty influential now. A lot of, you know, Neil Druckmann was nice enough. He wrote The Last of Us 2, The Last of Us 1 and 2. He said the game was very important to him. It's this game that valued the characters' internal strife. It's not what the characters can do, it's why they're doing it. And a lot of games now have much more of that focus. And that sort of echoes games now that often are about that, like the Fallout series. A lot of the Fallout series is about exploration, games like Gone Home. And they don't all originate with Silent Hill 2, but Silent Hill 2 was one of the first big-budget mainstream games to do this.
Mm-hmm. What current-day game do you think captures the psychological journey that Silent Hill 2 provided?
That's a really good question. I think there's a few good games that capture that right now. One of them is the Amnesia series. The Amnesia series is very interesting because you can't actually fight. It is a horror series where your options are to run or to hide. And again, the series is great about it drops you in the middle of things. You don't quite know why you're there. You figure out why you're there as you go. And the game's very different from Silent Hill 2. Like, these games take place in fantastical settings like a desert or a castle. But it has that same feeling of I'm lost, I'm confused, and I'm scared.
Mm-hmm. You recently tweeted out your new credit as executive producer for Full Frontal. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
It leads me to ask, what is on the horizon for you? What's next for you?
I honestly don't know. I've signed on to another year of this show, so this is my main focus. This book was like a big project of mine, and now that it's over, I almost have like, you know, that sense of like, what do I do now? Half of me is like, you got to do something now, figure something out. And the other half of me is like, can we just not do things anymore? I'm not sure. I'm really not sure what happens after this. There's like a few like cartoon ideas that a couple friends are trying to sell. But we'll see. We'll see.
Mike Drucker, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Mike Drucker is a comedian and co-head writer of Full Frontal with Samantha Bee. He's also the author of the book Silent Hill 2 from Boss Fight Books. Find out more at WPR.org. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Rose Glass, Amy Gentry, and Mike Drucker. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast. It's available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Tell me, has it ever crossed your mind that maybe it's everybody else's problem that they don't get along with you?
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
He's a real turkey. You know, you move his like 5 inches, that boy's going to starve to death.
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
I didn't even know to care about you sometimes, you ungrateful bastard.